Lecture number 14. Today we'll talk about basics of tensor networks. But first I want to tell you what we're going to do from now till the end of the course. So the next 5 lectures and 3 tutorials, we'll talk about tensor networks. We'll see today now basics of tensor networks. Then I will spend one and a half lectures talking about matrix product states. Matrix product state is an example of tensor network. There is a drawing attached to that. It's this one here. Matrix product state, we often refer to it as MPS, acronyms. We use acronyms a lot here. And hopefully by the end of, well, in 2 or 3 lectures, you know exactly what this drawing means. And then we'll talk about MERA, or this multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz. And it's another tensor network that has a drawing attached to it that looks like that. And then finally, we'll talk about, so MPS and MERA are tensor networks, these two, that are for 1+1 systems, ground states of, to describe ground states of 1+1 systems. And then we'll also talk about tensor networks in space dimensions larger than 1. OK, so basics of tensor networks. The first point I want to discuss, to talk about, is why should we care about these things? Why tensor networks? And let me remind you that you have some notes on the wiki. And one of the points in the, so there is a PDF called Basics of Tensor Networks, and one of the points there is why tensor networks, so I'm just going to read that loud, basically. Okay? So, but first, what we've been seeing is that we are interested in ground state, and we've been looking at ground state entanglement. And we've seen that there is this area law. And other maybe logarithmic corrections, etc. And we're going to exploit from now on. We're going to exploit this to build a tensor network description of the ground state. Okay. The idea is that we'll be able to describe this ground state in terms of a collection of tensors. Tensors, maybe alpha, beta, gamma, whatever, collection of tensors. These tensors will be connected according to some pattern. So here, this would be a tensor. This would be another tensor that will be connected in some way. And what's nice about this description, apart from being useful computationally, is that, interestingly, this description is local. I'm going to put it like this, local. In real space. And what that means is that we will be able to attach tensors to different positions of our lattice. So you could imagine your lattice lives here. Okay. And what we're doing is we are describing the full wave function, which in principle is all these 2 to the n coefficients where is no notion of where these coefficients belong. Especially, we'll be able to organize those that description as a product of tensors where this tensor here is naturally, in some sense, attached to this site. Okay, so we recover some sense of locality in the description, explicitly in the description of the wave function. In the case of MERA, there will be an extra dimension corresponding to scale. Okay, so this is space. We'll have space and scale. And so a tensor will be locally in space and scale in some sense that we will clarify. But the idea is that we can break this huge tensor into pieces. And these pieces are attached to positions in space or positions in space and scale and so on. And obviously, apart from being able to attach the properties, special properties of the wave function to different places in the tensor network, which I refer to as locality, we will also then obtain an efficient meaning order n instead, an efficient description. It's going to be order n instead of exponential in n. Okay, so what do I want to say? So then tensor networks, and now I'm just gonna, that's when I go to the end, to the notes that you have on the blackboard, on the wiki, and I say that I want to think of tensor networks as both as a natural language to describe many body systems, many body phenomena, and here I'm thinking mostly ground states, but you can extend that to low energy states, to partially also to some dynamics, to thermal states, and so on. So natural language to describe many body phenomena, and examples of this have been, the tensor networks have been used to classify quantum phases of matter. Specifically, symmetry protected topological order. You have this written in the notes. But they have also been useful to reformulate the renormalization group, and we'll see a bit of that. That's implicit here when I say that this tensor network, the tensors are organized according to space and scale. That direction will be the RG direction. Another example is a new insight. Tensor networks have provided new insights into holography. Okay. So tensor networks are being used as a toy model for this geometrization of space-time in relation to entanglement, and we'll mention that also at some point. And more recently, that's work in progress. So this is mostly on the lattice, okay? So this is typically lattice, but there is current effort to extend this, so current extension, to quantum field theories. Okay. So a lot of research nowadays goes into trying to understand how to duplicate this success of tensor networks on the lattice, how to do that also in the continuum. Very good. But this would be as a natural language to describe many body phenomena. This is just a language, a formalism, okay? A way of organizing the description. But also, of course, tensor networks are important as a basis for numerical simulations. That's the original motivation. And for instance, in condensed matter, nowadays tensor networks are used to study quantum critical systems, topological order, frustrated magnets, interacting fermions. I had the list somewhere. And I also mentioned applications beyond condensed matter, say machine learning, quantum error correction, statistical mechanics, quantum chemistry, etc. Okay? Very good. So the natural place to study tensor networks would be that I would come here and teach you how to program, you know, maybe with Julia, the algorithms attached to Tensor Network. Now, this is not what we're going to do. There is no time for this. And I also feel this would be too specialized for a master course. But so we're not going to do that. We're only going to talk about theoretical aspects of Tensor Networks according to this list. But I want you to know that you have, after understanding that theory, you have all the ingredients that you need to move on to learning algorithms, because you've learned enough Julia, and you would know the theory. So the next step, if you wanted to learn more about this topic, if you wanted to learn algorithms, you just have all the basic ingredients there. And there are plenty of people at Perimeter that can, you know, there are several postdocs and students working on these things. So there will be, if you want to learn more, you can learn more. Okay? There is also some specialized tensor network library that will help you with these algorithms to put the pieces together, which was developed by a student here. Okay. And several of you actually, at least a couple of you, are working in their Psi essays with tensor network algorithms. All right, so ...14.2, we've seen this. I'm just going to very briefly review this diagrammatic notation. And then we can make sense of those drawings. So remember what we said? We said that, what was this? We see circle with a leg. You have to help me there. I know we've seen this. Just please tell me what that was.
Vector.
Vector, right? So vector, matrix, okay, et cetera, et cetera. Tensor with three indices, tensor with n indices, and so on. Okay. And then we had, so that's individual elements. And if you see something like this, that would be matrix, matrix multiplication. So that would be equal to a matrix. If you see, similarly, if I give you this thing could be representing a wave function of four spins. So that would be psi dagger. And this could be just the scalar product of a wave function for four spins. Okay? So if I tell you that I have, if you see this, okay, that's just the product of many tensors. And if I multiply all these indices, what I'll end up with, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I'll end up with a tensor with six indices, which might be encoding the 2 to the n complex coefficients of a wave function. Okay, so every drawing there, what you see is a collection of tensors that if we multiply them together, there will be some open legs, right? There are two types of indices here, the ones that are connected, the ones that are open. Okay, and if we multiply all these tensors, the connected indices will disappear, and we'll be left with the open indices. And so every time you see something like this, you can think, oh, if I multiply these indices, I'll get a wave function of, say, in this case, six spins. Okay? Okay, so then I'm ready to define tensor networks by just repeating, almost repeating what I just said. So we will imagine that we have a vector space of a lattice of n sites, which we will assume to be C, D tensor product to the n. Okay. So D-level systems, n of those. And then if we have a wave function psi that a wave function of these n sides. Then we can represent this guy. As a tensor with n indices, and a tensor network decomposition will be of the form of put together a bunch of tensors . I'm just making up an example here of how to do that. Okay. I just drew something where this something consists of some number of tensors connected together, where the important property here, one important property, is that the number of open legs should be a match with the ones that we have here. Okay. And now the big question is, why would we want to do this type of thing? But is it clear that if we contract those indices, the Born indices, and then we get d to the n coefficient. So here we have d to the n coefficients. And here we'll see how many we have. Let me first say that I'm explicitly distinguishing between Born indices. So I'm going to call a guy like this, a Born index. It's connecting two tensors. I'm going to be calling a guy like this a physical index. Okay, that's just the way we call things. But the idea is that physical indices really, in a tensor network, really correspond to the original degrees of freedom, the spin variable. So it's labeling different an orthonormal basis on a given side of your lattice. Maybe it's spin up and down. So this physical index, say I2, takes values from 1 all the way to d. That's because it's labeling a basis on CD, which is the original Hilbert space of one side. Whereas the Born index, let me call it alpha, it's going to be ranging from 1. It's going to be taking some number of values, chi. Okay. Chi, we're going to say it's the Born dimension. And after introducing Born indices and physical indices, we're ready to discuss why should we care about breaking or writing a wave function in this way. And here is the reason. Suppose chi is not a function of system size. Okay? Suppose we fix chi is equal to 100. So the dimension of these indices, suppose it's fixed. It's 100, 10, I don't care. A fixed number, independent of n. Then what we want to understand is how many parameters go into writing this decomposition, into specifying all these tensors. Okay? And here is how many, right? So in this example, what you see is that each tensor, let's draw a typical tensor, maybe this, maybe that. Okay? So the upper ones have 3 legs, the lower ones have 4 legs. Let me write, so we had that this index here would take d values, and maybe the other indices take chi different values. Okay? So, anyway, I'm going to use purple. It's hard to tell. Okay. So, imagine all these indices take chi values. The important thing is that this tensor then would take chi 3 values, the tensor itself, right? It's a tensor with 3 indices. It, each index runs from 1 to chi. So we have chi to the 3 entries on this tensor. Okay, is that clear? This one is maybe chi 3 times d. Okay. It's a tensor with 4 indices. It has chi 3 times d values inside. Okay. And the important thing is that none of these numbers depends on the system size. So what that means is that the total number of parameters here, number of parameters, is maybe chi 3 plus chi 3d. That's for this tensor and that tensor. And then how many times do we do this? N, right? There are n. The number of tensors that we have is scales linearly in the system size. Okay? So the number of parameters is order n. Okay? Whereas on this side here, the number of coefficients or parameters is d to the n. And that's everything. I mean, everything starts or follows from this observation. Okay, that if we want to add an extra leg here, what do we need to do? We need to multiply whatever resources we put into this times d. Okay. So if you use a laptop to store this wave function, if you add one extra site to your system, you have to instead go from one laptop to d laptop to be able to continue to work. Whereas in this scheme here, if I want to add an extra site, I'll just put here a pair of new tensors. And that means that instead of n, here I'll have to put 1. Okay. So it's just linear growth, not exponential. Okay. So your laptop with a little bit more memory will be able to. It's just a simple observation, exponential versus linear. But really, think about it, because it has very important implications. All right, so is this clear? Are there questions?
But is the process of obtaining the coefficients like also efficient or something?
A very good question. How can we obtain the exponentially many coefficients efficiently? We can.
No, but in the tensor network, like you have to like train the tensor network.
Oh, right? Training the tensor network.
Yeah.
Are you a machine learning person? So yes, we will have to demand many more things. Okay. So we will need to require that we can optimize these variational parameters in the tensor. Right. Each tensor has a number of parameters. We're going to look at that, at those as variational parameters, those parameters that we can choose to try, say, to minimize the expectation value of the energy of a Hamiltonian. There will be some work to be done, and we'd better have an efficient algorithm for that. That's right. Very good. All right, so I'll try to specify a bit better what requirements we need besides an efficient representation in a minute. Okay. But yeah, that's the starting point. If we don't have an efficient representation, if we cannot write the wave function in terms of a number of coefficients that is, say, linear in n, then we stop there. Right? So this is a necessary condition to be able to move on.
MPS usually only has one layer, and this has two layers.
Yes.
Is it still contractible in a decent amount of
this type of question? You'll learn to answer yourself by the end of today in the tutorial. Well, maybe you will. Okay, so let's start by working with very simple examples. The first one is I'm gonna assume, just to understand better the meaning of these bond indices, I'm gonna assume that I don't have bond indices. So what we could do is first consider product state. Okay? Remember, product state is not entangled. For n sides, we would say it's the product of individual states for each side. Now, that means that the wave function, this 2 to the n coefficients, are nothing but the product of the coefficients for the first side times the coefficient for the second side times the coefficient for the last side. Okay? And let's try to represent this diagrammatically. What we're saying is that in this case, this we have n of these indices, i1, i2, in. But in this case, the wave function can be written in a much simpler way as the product of vectors. Right? So when we have a product state, we knew from the beginning that there is no difficulty in efficiently representing it, because you just need to represent state for the first side, state for the second side, and so on. Okay. Now, how many resources go into describing the state of the first side? Well, the state of the first side will be a linear combination of basis vectors on the first side. So we said that there. This index goes from 1 to d, okay? So it will take d complex coefficients, the number of parameters here, or coefficients, is equal to d for this guy, right? D for this guy, d for this guy, so n times, right? So we can specify a product state with d times n complex coefficients. Okay? But what we will see is that this state is not very useful, or there is some limit to how useful this type of states can be to describe many-body physics. They are still useful, but you know, there is a serious limit to how useful they are. And you can think of these bond indices. So the problem here is that its side is uncorrelated from the rest. So this wave function has no correlation. You put a connected correlator between one side and another one, it's going to be zero. Okay? So the role of bond indices, the reason why we are going to later on put in a tensor network such as a matrix product state, we're going to have this bond index here, is to allow for correlations between the different sides. Right. But you can think of this as the simplest tensor network. It's a collection of tensors that don't talk to each other. They are not connected. Another example that we will discuss or a very simple example will be a quantum circuit. Okay, so what we're going to have here is some wires, and some initial state, which is going to be a product state. And then we'll have gates acting on pairs of wires. And we'll actually assume that there are t different rows of gates. So the depth of the circuit is t. So we start with the product state. And then we apply these gates. So t rows of gates. Okay. And this produces some wave function down here, which depends on which gates we've been applying. Okay? So this could be something that we go to the Institute for Quantum Computing or any other lab where they try to build quantum states. And we can tell them, look, this is a prescription how to build some wave function in a lab. These are gates to site, or let's say 2-qubit unitary transformation. And this is a prescription how to produce a wave function by making pairs of these qubits interact sequentially in this way. Okay. Now, here we are not going to look at this as a recipe or a prescription to tell our friend in a lab how to produce this state. We're just going to look at it as a way of specifying the state, as an efficient way of specifying a state. Right? This wave function that we're preparing here, will be we can specify it completely by specifying all these gates. So, and let's look at how many resources it takes to prepare to specify this state. So here, this would be, if this is d-dimensional, if these wires are d-dimensional, then this is d squared times d squared unitary matrix. Okay? So it has d to the 4 parameters. And then how many do we have? Well, maybe I should say that we have n wires or n systems. Then the number of gates is t times n. Okay, scales as t times n. And so this gives you the number of complex parameters you need to specify this wave function at the end. Okay? So if t is equal to, say, polynomial in n, then this whole thing is just polynomial in n. It's not exponential. So here's a recipe how to efficiently specify wave function. Instead of giving me 2 to the n complex coefficients, give me a quantum circuit that prepares a wave function. Okay? You just have to give me a list of gates. And that, if you give me polynomially many gates, then that is an efficient specification. It doesn't take exponentially many coefficients. OK, but what we will see next, we will start asking, well, how useful is this, right? So am I saying that we can now efficiently simulate any state that the quantum computer can prepare, right? This is what a quantum computer would be doing in the lab. So no, I'm just saying that I can efficiently specify a wave function. There is a very important difference between efficiently specifying a wave function and knowing how to compute properties of wave function. Okay? And I will insist in this point. Very good. So next point then is what makes the tensor network useful. This is a tensor network. Clearly, we have tensors multiplied together. But we need to understand whether every time that we put, that we draw some bunch of tensors and connect them together, whether that is going to be a useful tensor network or not. So let's discuss this. That's 14.4. What makes a tensor network useful? And we will see that we need to satisfy simultaneously 3 conditions. Okay. We want A, efficient specification or efficient representation. But we also, and this is what we've seen already in the 2 examples that we described, the product state and the quantum circuit. But we also want efficient manipulation. So efficient representation of the wave function. The number of parameters should not grow exponentially. We want an efficient manipulation. right? So what's the point of having an efficient specification of Psi if we cannot answer questions like how much is an expectation value? We cannot answer questions of what are the properties of this wave function, physically meaningful properties. Or maybe what if we also need to know, given a Hamiltonian, how to produce this wave function. Okay? We need an efficient way of doing this. And finally, that would be very interesting from a computational perspective. Can we do this efficiently? But of course, another necessary condition for this tensor network to be useful is that it offers an accurate approximation to many body states of interest. Right? In the end, in the space of states, we may want to describe this ground state. That's the true ground state. Okay. And now what we're saying is that we're going to consider some efficient description for a subclass of states. Right? This is tensor network, whatever your favorite tensor network, will define some subset of possible wave functions only. And if the best approximation you can get to the true ground state is still very different from the ground state, then this tensor network may not be very useful, right? You are trying to learn about the ground state of the system, and maybe your tensor network gives you something that behaves completely differently. Then you haven't learned anything, even though you have efficient algorithms, and you know, you can say, oh, I can go to 25 spins. Yeah, so what? Or 25, we could do it already. We can go to 1,000 spins, right? I have an efficient way of describing wave functions, some wave function, on say 1,000 spins. Well, yes, but if those wave functions, even after optimization, they don't give you any useful information about the ground state of your Hamiltonian, then the whole thing is useless. So specifically here, an accurate approximation to many body states of interest, it's not very clear how to gauge that, but what we will do in these lectures is to look at whether a given tensor network can match certain structural properties that we know are exist for ground states. So we're going to try to match scaling of entanglement of correlations and of entanglement entropy. Okay. So what I'm saying is, in the end, we won't be able, just by drawing things, to assess whether this tensor network or that tensor network are going to give you a good approximation to ground states. But what we can do is we can ask, does this tensor network, does this tensor network or this tensor network, do they actually, can they display correlations that are, say, exponentially suppressed with distance or power law decay? Do they give you entanglement entropy that is saturated or that grows logarithmically as we find in ground state? Okay, these are the type of questions we will be able to answer. And this is useful because if we have a tensor network that cannot, we show that cannot emulate, say, the decay of correlations on ground states or the entanglement entropy of ground states, if a tensor network cannot do that, then just throw it away, right? It's not going to be able to give you a reasonable approximation to ground state. Okay? So we have a checklist for any tensor network that we will discuss from now on. We'll ask these three questions. Do we have an efficient representation? If yes, we can go on. If not, throw it, right? Can we efficiently manipulate? If the answer is no, move on to another tensor network. If yes, the most important question, is this tensor network really approximating ground states? Okay. All right? So that's what we're going to do for the next 2-3 lectures. We're just going to take specific tensor networks and go through our list of requirements. So going back to example one, we have this product state. And now we want to apply our list just to warm up. So A, do we have an efficient specification? Who's going to answer this one? How many parameters did we say we needed to represent n spins or n sites? Is it too easy for you to answer? It's too easy.
Oh, I see. You're embarrassed too.
Okay. So who is not embarrassed to say something very easy? I'm not. What we said was that the number of parameters was the n, on the, which means order n, right? So specification, good. But now we start asking tougher questions. Can we efficiently manipulate it? Okay. So actually, the answer may be yes again, but we need to understand what that means. So let's do this one here. Let's ask, how do we compute the expectation value of a local operator? So how do we compute say sigma z or x on site 3 for this guy, okay? And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to draw it. I'm saying this is psi. This, so this would be the ket. We put the bra. Okay, ket, bra. And now I'm going to put sigma x on site 3, this guy here, it's a metric, right? It has two indices. And now I'm taking the scalar product. So I'm subtracting all these indices. Now what we see is that in order to compute this expectation value, we need to multiply these guys together. We need to multiply these guys together, these guys together. This is vector matrix vector, vector vector, vector vector, and so on. So remember that the cost of this manipulation was order d, right? D dimensional vector times d dimensional vector. We have to make a sum over the products of components. So that's going to be d. This one is going to be d. This one is going to cost us d. We have order n of those. And this one is matrix vector, so it's going to be d squared. Okay. So this can be done with order. There is a d squared plus n d. Okay, so we're going to say this is order n. Okay, we can efficiently compute expectation values of local operators when we have a product state. Okay, so that means that we're just going to be looking at things like how much is computing the norm or how much is computing the expectation value. And what we see is that with a product state, we can do this efficiently. Okay. And now the toughest question. So is this product state useful or not? And as I said, are product states offering a good, accurate approximation to ground state? And that's where the product state may run out of luck. So C, good approximation. Yep.
Why would you actually calculate the ones where you contract a wave function with its own Hermitian conjugate?
Oh, we just want to know what the norm. So any expectation value that we care about is actually the ratio between the observable, right, in quantum mechanics. Either you assume that the state is normalized,
okay,
or the expectation value has to be divided by the norm.
But if it's normalized, you don't have to calculate that thing because you know it's one. Like the
it's normalized. That's you could just normalize it. So you could normalize each of these guys individually.
Okay. Those things, like the ones where there is no orange ball in the middle, they drop out of the quotient.
If you had normalized the state from the beginning.
No, that quotient. There's a quotient there.
Yeah.
And in the numerator is a product over all of the things, where one of them has that orange ball.
Yes.
And
so,
the denominator is the same.
So Nick is saying that if we only care about the ratio.
Yes. Yeah, it's just one.
Where this is a local operator, then this one simplifies with this one simplifies with this one, and you only need to compute this ratio. And then this drops to order one. Okay, then I'll say, yes, this is correct, this is true, and maybe I want to compute the expectation value of a string operator, and then, right? So you're right.
Yeah, if it's order L, where L is
the number of insertion.
Yeah,
that's true. That's true. So you may be able to further improve these things. But I was trying to make the point that this is efficient, and now you're saying, oh, you can do even more efficient, right? That's true. Very good. So now, is it a good approximation? And so first, let's look at how much is the expectation value of a connected correlator. So I want to ask the question, if I compute expectation value of sigma x on site 3 and sigma x on 5 on site 5, right? So, and I want to subtract from it sigma x on site 3, expectation value, and also the expectation value of sigma 5 or sigma x on site 5. Okay. Question is, how much is this? Okay. And we are going to see in a second that this is 0. It's a product state, so no surprise there. But let's look at it diagrammatically. So I'm not going to assume that everything is normalized, so I'm not dividing by the norm. And this is very easy to see, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So let me first draw. So that's a diagram for this expectation value. I'm going to assume that individual pi one have already been normalized. Okay. So this is a 1, this is a 1, this is 1, 1. So this is just the product of the two insertions on sites 3 and 5. But this is exactly what this times this is, right? So let's take this one. And then the other one. I'm saying that because if I assume that each individual site has a state that is normalized, I can drop this guy, these two, this. So I'm left with what I had here. And on this side, I can drop everything that is except for one term and everything here. I'm just removing ones, right? It's a product. Every time you multiply something by one, you can remove the one. What I'm saying is that this guy is the product of these two contributions. But this is exactly what this product of contributions is, right? This one gives you one, that the other. So be more specific. This was sigma x on site 3. This was sigma x on site 5. This is sigma x on site 3, sigma x on site 5. Okay. So clearly, this state has vanishing connected correlation. Correlators. I can also ask you, how does entanglement entropy scale in this case? Okay. So if I had to draw as a function of L the entropy of a region L, you can tell me what the answer is, because we discussed that before. In a product state, when you trace out all the sites except for L, you are left with a pure state. So how much is the entropy? Yes? You are all thinking 0? Yes? Good. So entropy is 0. Okay? So we see that the product state is nice. We have an efficient specification. We have a way of manipulating it efficiently. And the only problem is that when we ask how useful it is, well, it's giving us wave functions that are uncorrelated, zero entanglement entropy. So how are we going to match the this is not a match with the expected properties of ground state. Okay? Where we would have exponential or power law decay of correlation, and where we would have a saturation or logarithmic scaling of entanglement entropy. And yet, let me tell you that product states are actually very, very useful. Okay? So it's they are not very accurate representations, but this is what mean field theory is about, where just to go to an example of system that we've been discussing here, that you are familiar with, let's go back to the IZ model. So in this case, what we had was that as a function of some magnetic field, we could have, I could plot here the magnetization, the expectation value, and expectation value of, so mx is the expectation value of sigma x, okay, on any side. And remember, the Hamiltonian was sigma x, plus h, sigma z, something like that. So what we have is that there are two phases, symmetry breaking and disordered. So symmetry breaking. We have the phases of, as a function of the magnetic field. And what's interesting is that both for zero magnetic field and for infinite magnetic field, the ground state is actually a product state. Okay? So for infinite magnetic field, what we had is the ground state was aligned with the magnetic field. So with respect to sigma z. And for zero magnetic field, what we had was that there was symmetry breaking, and the ground state was aligned, was a product state in the x direction, maybe plus x or minus x. Okay? But it turns out that then if we use a product state as our answer for approximating the ground state of this Hamiltonian, well, we know that in the limit of zero magnetic field, we'll get the exact solution within this variational class. In the limit of very large magnetic field, we'll get the exact solution. Okay? And in between, it turns out that you can actually see that the state is hesitating between being in this direction or being in that direction, and it stops hesitating around the phase transition. It keeps roughly this solution here keeps being the best that you can have for a finite range of magnetic fields. This solution is also the best you can have within this variational class, and somewhere near the phase transition, you go from one solution to the other. So it's actually capturing the essence of the phase diagram. Okay? So I just criticized product states as being too simple, not being able to encode correlations or entanglement entropy, but I'm not saying it's completely useless. Okay? There are, for instance, when you study symmetry breaking phases, product states or mean field theory can be extremely useful. There are thousands and thousands of papers using mean field theory. All right. But that would not be true, for instance, if we study a system with topological order, where the type of order that we have requires a lot of entanglement to start with. Okay. So that's just because the representative of the phases, the RG fixed points for these two gap phases, happen to be a product state. There are RG fixed points for gap phases which are not a product state. And then using mean field theory is not going to be a good idea. Or to describe the wave function near criticality, product state is going to be a disaster as well. Okay. So the second example, I will go a bit fast now. I want to talk about the second example. I'm going to do some magic trick. Hello? Can I have the screen, please? I've been told this would work.
Honestly?
Thank you. Excellent. So now I want to talk about our second example, and I'll do that in the couple of minutes that we have left. So I want to talk about the quantum circuit. Okay, we can specify a wave function by specifying a quantum circuit that prepares it. And the question is, can we also efficiently manipulate this wave function? Can we efficiently extract information from it? Okay. And finally, what type of properties will this wave function have? Will it be a good approximation to ground state? OK, so that's almost there. And so I'm just referring to the notes that you have. All right, so what I wanted to tell you is that when we try to compute expectation values with this quantum circuit, so first we may want to compute the norm, right? So our wave function is prepared by just this sequence of gates. Did I do something wrong here? Not yet? Okay. So the first question we want to ask is how much is the expectation value, the norm, or the scalar product? Oh, it was not connected. OK, very good. Thank you.
Yeah.
You're good, huh? So this is the scalar product of psi with itself, right? It's prepared the state. And it's complex, it's a joint conjugate here. And now this is a unitary gate. And this it's a joint conjugate. So u times u dagger is going to cancel. Right? It's going to be the identity. This will cancel with this. This will cancel with this. This will be replaced with the identity. And so this will be multiplied directly with this one. But again, u dagger, everything will cancel. Okay? So the result is what's the norm of a wave function that has been prepared through a quantum circuit. It's 1 from the beginning because this quantum circuit is just implementing a unitary transformation. So if you start with the state 0, 0, 0, apply a unitary transformation and do the unitary transformation and ask with the overlap with 0, 0, 0, it's the overlap. It's the norm of 0, 0, 0 from the beginning. Okay? This part is u. This is u dagger. You can remove it all. You get this scalar product. That's 1. So it's looking good. We can efficiently compute the norm. Now, how about computing expectation value of sigma x on side 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. We insert some operator on side 10. This is preparing psi. This is the conjugate. And this is the insertion. And the question is, how much is this? Well, we don't know. But what we know is that this is a unitary transformation, u dagger. So it will cancel. There will be lots of cancellations, okay, as before. Well, but not as many as before, because this is a unitary transformation. This is conjugate. But there is an insertion in between, so we cannot simplify it. And so what we have to do is, well, we can remove all the legs that have no gates left, so we are left with this. And the question is how hard it is to contract this. Okay? And this afternoon in the tutorial, you'll learn that this is exponential, or you will learn how to assess the complexity. You will ask to assess the complexity of certain circuits. And this one, for instance, we'll see that the cost is exponential in the number of rows of gates. Exponential in this t, the depth of the quantum circuit. So we are back to exponential in the depth. If the depth was, constant, if we have n spins or n sites and only a quantum circuit of depth 3, okay, then the cost, we can also efficiently compute things, extract information. Finally, let's look at then properties. So this is what would be a two-point correlator. Okay? We have two insertions, the blue and the white and the red. And again, there will be lots of cancellations here when we try to compute the expectation value of a two-point correlator. So we see that it will break into two expectation values. Okay, but then that means that the connected correlators, again, will be 0, right? Because this is the expectation value of just having the blue insertion. And this is the expectation value of just having the red insertion. So if we say, what's the expectation value? We did that before somewhere. If we ask, what's this expectation value with two insertions minus the expectation value of the product of expectation values for each of the insertions, since this one factorizes as this product, this is going to be zero. So this factorization tells you that when you look at correlations sufficiently far away, the connected correlator is zero again. Now, what we use here is that the two insertions were sufficiently separated. If the two insertions had been closer to each other, they would not, you know, if the second insertion was here, if this is blue and then this is red, then we would have number of gates that don't annihilate, and this factorization would not have taken place. The net result being that this type of wave function can actually give you correlations, non-trivial correlations, for some range, and then it drops to zero. This is not what we find in ground states, but this could still be useful. Okay? But in the end, so the range, what you can argue is that the correlations become trivial when the two points are separated at distance order t. Okay? Remember the depth of the circuit. So if the two insertions are a distance larger than the depth of the circuit, the correlator is zero. If they are closer, the correlator might not be zero. Okay? So that's already useful. Okay? But not useful enough in the sense that what we saw is that the cost grows with exponential in t in the depth of the circuit. Okay? So we have that the cost was exponential in t. And now what we see is that correlations may be non-trivial all the way to a distance t and then become absolutely zero. Okay? Correlation as a function of L. Okay? So this type of wave function may be able to reproduce correlations all the way to some distance t. But if we want to reproduce correlations a longer distance, we'll have to pay a cost which is exponential with this distance. Okay, so finally, I think there was some statement about entanglement entropy right there. So if we try to compute the reduced density matrix in a case for a region in, so this would be the reduced density matrix for some central region, then we'll see that there will be many cancellations again, but we will be left with some part of the wave function with some tensor network. So this tensor network represents the reduced density matrix. And what's important is that this tensor network representing the density matrix, these are Bra indices, these are Ket indices, and they are connected through a number of indices. This afternoon you will learn that you will learn to characterize this. When you have some number of indices connecting the Bra and Ket part of the density matrix, you'll be able to give an upper bound to how much the entanglement entropy can be. And you will see that in this particular configuration, then you will be able to argue that at most you have an amount of entropy that is saturated to a constant given precisely by order t. Okay? So if you want to have a wave function, in this case a quantum circuit that prefers a wave function with more entanglement entropy, you have to pay an exponential cost. Okay? The entropy grows proportional to t, the cost grows exponentially. So the idea is this is actually kind of a good tensor network in the sense that it will allow you to simulate certain things. But we will see in the next lecture, which is at 11:30 or something, that we can do much, much better than those. Okay? All right. Sorry I went almost 10 minutes beyond the time. Are there questions? We can keep talking. We'll have a second lecture at 11:30. Okay.